Now, this is Channel 2 over, and I'm continuing the third day on Whitman on Monday, the 13th of May, 1968, and this is the eighth week. I'm continuing now the third day on Whitman. I'm going through finishing the Song of the Open Road, and pretty soon I'll get to the preface, 1855. And this is Channel 2 over.
Lose prizes, but offer rough new prizes. In 12, he uses a term that he likes so much. Alons, after the great companion. Now, that's the great companions, you see. And then he has a list of where where he's making that concrete. The great companions, the pausers and contemplators of tufts and blossoms and dancers at weddings, they are the great companions. All those others. Now, in his terms, you see, the great companions can be those he's never seen before. And in 13, you see, that has one part that you might get out of that is property, you see. He says, property now. Somewhat like Thoreau, he owns what he sees, and he gets more out of it than the owner does. Don't you remember? Thoreau talked about that at Baker Farm. To see no possession, but you may possess it, enjoying all without labor or purchase. Now, there's a section in this, the last part of that, the last paragraph of section 13, that doesn't belong in it. It's another poem, but it's not in this. That is the presence of evil. Every person has something in him that is a source of loathing and despair. We see that clashes with the poem. He doesn't promise the smooth prizes. You see, it's a journey of struggle, and it's something shall come forth to make a greater struggle necessary. And then 15, alone, the road is before us. And he writes some words of encouragement. It is safe. I have tried it. My own feet have tried it well. Be not detained. Let the paper remain on the desk unwritten, and the book on the shelf unopened, depending on past elections. And on one old election they're commenting on it, I don't remember because I was writing a dissertation then. And another election they talk about, I don't remember, you see, because I was involved in something else, my own personal affairs. And so the world passes, you see, and we don't see it. What else you want to say about it? Sounds very Emersonian to you, the whole thing. Yes. He seems to have just absorbed Emerson and worked it out so that it's clearer to him than it is to Emerson. Yes, that's possible. Now, he says in one place the poet, you see, has to be a poem, not just think it. I tell you what, let's run through this other one that I asked you to do. preface 1855. Now, what I would like to do is ask you a few questions, let you carry the ball on that. Now, this is basic, based on Emerson. Now, what would you say he does in this? What would be the main direction of this preface, 1855? But actually, you see, a poet is a person who, as a poet now, a poet is a person who thinks and makes things beautiful and is introspective, and in our day, he writes like T.S. Eliot, and he writes a book or two, you see, takes footnotes to work it out. In our time, we don't have a natural poet anymore, do we? I'm just talking with you. Any idea of beauty? Good. Our beauty in here, you know. He has statements on beauty. We'll get to that. Let's go ahead. Roger, the poet now, he has something to say here about the poet. What is he saying about the poet? Let me tell you. You can make a statement on this. You have almost 2 months now of background. Now you can use that background to make a statement on this. You say he's talking about the poet. And he's also derivative of it from Emerson. Now who is the poet then as he speaks to the poet? Go ahead. Yes, that's Emerson. But Emerson, what does Emerson call him? In the American Scholar, what does he call him? Who's Emerson talking about in the American Scholar? He's talking about the scholar. He calls him the scholar. It's the tail end one he does. Now, in Self-Reliance, what's he talking about? It's not the scholar or the poet. What? It's one term for it. Yeah. Genius. It's a genius, you see, of the individual that he's interested in. Now, he doesn't call him a genius, but it's a genius that the individual has. Now, Emerson, Whitman, has to be talking about the same thing as he speaks of a poet. That's crying. Yes. Melville say in Knights and Squires. Be insane. Doesn't he? Doesn't Melville have to talk about the same thing? That makes them knights and squires. That puts them back in the category of the old nobility. That's where he gets his term. He's adapting the thought from the old regime, you see, ancient regime. When are you going to... You see, this the sort of things I'm working with you on is abstract and requires a considerable degree of intellection. But you're getting the background. Now, why don't you take hold, you see, and handle this material. Take hold and handle it. You've got nothing else to do in class but talk and try. And you say, I don't grade you on your errors. I take out even on your papers. I take out the best parts. Almost every paper I read, there's some silly stuff in it. If you read mine, probably be even more. I don't look for that. I look for the good parts. Now let's run through this. Yes. Whitman does not deny the past. What does Whitman, what does Emerson say about the past? What is he about the past? In the influence of the scholar. Of the influence of the scholar, what's the most important? What? I couldn't hear you. In the influences on the scholar, which is the most important? What's the next important? What is the next important? The past. Now, what does Whitman say? He starts off with the thing that's essential in that essay. The three factors in the education of the scholar: nature, the past, and action is last. Now look at his emphasis. It's a different emphasis, you see? The poet does not deny the past, but he thinks, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know just how he regards the past. But it's not as important for him as it is for Emerson. But he thinks about it, he says that. Look at that, where he says, the new life and the new forms. That's the primary purpose of the scholar, or the individual, or the poet, or the great companion. All these terms, about the same. I want you to mark your book. I'm working through it with you. That's the first paragraph. I'm taking it paragraph to paragraph. Now look at paragraph 2. But the United States itself is the greatest poem. And look what he says about it. Isn't that marvelous? In other words, he's thinking about the United States in Emersonian terms. In the history of the earth hitherto, the largest and most stirring appear tame and orderly to their ampler largeness and stir. Now, did you ever hear such patriotism? Here at last is something in the doings of man that corresponds with the broadness of day and night. Why, he even likens it, you see, to the creation in Genesis 1. Here is action, untied from strings, magnificently moving masses. You know, Mark Twain, when he went to visit the Holy Land, he said, it's such a puny little country compared to all this magnificent West. And we just throw away our West and read the little concordances on what they say about the Holy Land when there's not any well left in the well of Jacob. No water left there. This marvelous great country of ours. Oh, do you know what? Some of my finest friends made a tour of the West. They were standing up over, looking over the Colorado River. And I said, it's too hot out there, so they went back and got in their air-conditioned motel and turned on the television. The senator of Mississippi said, no! It was a great mistake for this poor people's march. I don't think anything is a great mistake that calls forth noble action. I'm not an activist. I'm just saying in terms of this. The outdoors, he says, is the making of heroic deeds. Now look in paragraph 3. In the countries of the old world, we judge them and see them, you see, in terms of their deputies, their ambassadors, and their poets, and their politicians, and all. And in this country, who stands for this country? Common, ordinary men. And that's what Eric Hoffer said about President Truman. He said they were 10 cents a dozen. You could pick up a candidate for President of the United States in any courthouse. Eric Hoffer.
T.S. Eliot.
We dull our minds with all those bibliographies. Preparing ourselves for what? Retirement, I guess. When we get old, we'll read Whitman and see what he's talking about. That's a hell of a note, isn't it? We get old. Old is 40, I'm sure. Now look here, I'm just talking to you. Now, number four. Now, the poet, he says, catches the spirit. And what does he do? He sings the great psalm of the republic. Now, that's a marvelous thing. Even the lowly, you see what he's saying, even the lowly is Thoreau's Canadian woodchopper. Now, look what he says about it. About the lowliest people, there is that indescribable freshness and unconsciousness about an illiterate person that humbles and mocks the power of the noblest expressive genius. And you know some of the name droppers that I have known who talk about the president of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and, you know, all such big people as that. When it comes to the showdown and they talk privately and seriously, the plumber who comes to unstop the sink has more to offer to them in good talk than the president of the American Museum of Natural History. Now, I don't know him, you understand. I'm not throwing off on that particular character. In our own time, now, I'll just say it to you. I'm picking up the spirit of this. Who you want to talk to. Now you can throw off on those people who's in the mainstream, you see, in the mainstream. I can't talk to you too privately because you'll quote me. But see, the mainstream, you know, the presidential candidates. Well, we won't go into that. Now look, the poet, he says in paragraph 5, I'm just working along with you on it. The poet, what is the poet? What does the poet do? How does he exert influence? The poet is a presence. Now, where did he get the idea of presence? We don't have it. That's not a modern idea. It's a curious thing. It's one we take over from the Middle Ages. You see, any royal person had the presence. And even though you didn't know you were there, that it was a royal person, you could feel it. That was the old theory. That's the presence of royalty. And what he's saying is, you see, that the scholar, or the individual with that genius, or the poet, as he says here, is a presence. He doesn't attack and argue and analyze, you see, but just the presence of the great poet conquers. And in his presence, as he says there, is not left any vestige of despair or misanthropy or cunning or exclusiveness and all those things. You can read it. He talks about beauty. Is not in rhyme, uniformity, abstract addresses, and melancholy complaints or good precepts. Now, he makes several fine statements there about beauty. Beauty comes from beautiful blood and beautiful brain. Health, as much as anything else. And then he gives you these signs of beauty. And then there's a marvelous passage. This is what you shall do. You see that passage? Look at it. Love the earth and the sun, and do all these other things, and your very flesh shall become a great poem. Point out something in paragraph 7. The poet, he says, looks for simplicity. Now, this again is on literary matters. And Whitman thinks of a marked style of elegance or effect or originality. And he says that they hang in the way between me and the rest like curtains. Now look at that and see what you think he means. In the case of Pole, Pole has so much rhythm and music that it stands in the way of what he's trying to say. And that's one reason Whitman commented unfavorably on Pole. Poe's got so much music, it defeats any effort to get to the salt. You just can't do it. See, the poem, the Raven, is a beautiful poem, but no one could tell you. If I ask you right now what the Raven's about, you'd have no idea. And if you read it right now, you still couldn't say what it's about. And that's what he's saying, you see, that the poem has got that too much art, you see, will hinder the mind. And in 8, he has this extraordinary statement that all can understand the poet. That's his view. He says, the poet says, come to us on equal terms. Now let me ask you, one of his, Whitman's disillusionments was he found that the common people couldn't understand him. And what they knew about him, they were hostile towards him. They didn't like him. So in a way, what it boils down to is that readers of Whitman, and he throws off on the scholars, but it takes a scholar to interpret Whitman. I don't think any common man or any ordinary student or any student within the length of time you have, would ever even get close to Whitman. And see, now there's one of his great errors. Come to us on equal terms, he says. On prudence. Number 9 is marvelous on prudence. Now that's a prudence, you see, that would carry us through. It has been thought that the prudent citizen was a citizen that applied himself to solid gains and all those things. But Whitman says that's not needed. Beyond the independence of a little sum laid aside for burial money and a few clapboards around us and shingles above us, and not much more we need. That way of prudence. And in 10, I want you to remember this and look at this in the next paragraph, 10, where he says the great quality of the poet is that he lives. If he does not flood himself with the immediate age as with vast oceanic tides. You see that? Huh? Direct trial of him who would be the greatest poet is today. You see that? The direct trial of himself with immediate age. Now, what does Whitman do in the beginning of Specimen Days for the taxi drivers in New York and the operas? What does he do? He floods himself in the immediate age. Now let me ask you, do you flood yourself in the immediate age? If so, what do you call flooding and what is the age? I don't know. You see, I've lived with Whitman since I was younger than you. And all the time I've spent in classrooms, I have done it when I was a great failure somewhere else. The only reason I went to school was I couldn't do anything else. But not that I didn't try. So I'd try and hit the rocks and go back to school a little while, you see. And now I've just hit the rocks permanently, you see, and I stay in school. Yes, I've lived with Whitman since I was younger than you are, and Mark Twain and Emerson. And I can't speak to you personally like this, but I can just help you interpret them. Now, the thing I think will help you as much as anything else is to take hold of one of these, just one of these common thoughts, positions, and work it out for your term paper. Not your term paper. I don't want you to do it as a term paper. I just want you to do it. Take 2 or 3 days and do it. Now take the line that I worked with you on last time. The you objects you call from the refuge in my thought. You see, that brings up his attitude towards art. And what he is, how far he's willing to go in art. And one of the factors, you see, is the concreteness. Objects are more important to him, you see, than abstractions. Now, you can follow the same thoughts you see in the other writers. I don't want you to compare writers. That's mechanical. And you don't know enough about the writers to compare them. But you can pick up the same thoughts in them. Or you can take this, the attitude towards the commonplace. Now you see, it's not just the common. They don't espouse the common. But it's like in Knights and Squires, the common can, on occasion, rise to heroic, he calls heroic action. But just the mere fact that it's common and plentiful, you see, is not in its favor. I'll work out 3, 4, 5, any number of these little points that you can work on. Now, you've gone far enough. Whitman's far enough for you. You're ready to start to work on it. What I want you to do... You ask me how long. You see, that's a sort of a primary, sort of elementary, sort of a second-grade question. How long do I want it? I want you to consider, I want you to use a great deal of information in it. You think fast, you write fast, and then you ask me how long I want it, and you'd be pleased if I say 1.5 pages. You see, that's pretty elementary. I want you to make it as long as you can. I'm not going to judge it as art, you see. I'll follow Whitman principles, Emersonian outlook. I'll let you pursue your subject. I won't judge you as long as you keep moving. Now, next time, what I would like for you to do is you do the commenting on Song of Myself, the first 12 or 15 of those sections. You make statements on what he says in each one. Write it out at the head of your paper, of your book. And I'll ask you, and you make a statement, then we'll talk about your statement. Now, you see, today I've had to do the work, most of it. I've had to make the statements. Now, next time you make statements. On Friday, I'll give you a little reading test on Whitman. And I'll include in that one or two of the better poems. And then I'll lay out next week's work, or at least for the next 2 days, and that's the turn of the screw. Now, the turn of the screw shows something that you ought to see. This marvelous fine world that produced Emerson and Whitman and Mark Twain and some of the others, Emily Dickinson, goes to pieces. And you see that in Turn of the Screw. All these values are overturned. And you set out into the world we live in. And you see that in that little story. But I'll have to help you on it, unless you want to read some of the criticism, or unless you use some of this Emersonian background. So it's a extraordinary world that you get. Come up after class, and I'll check it with you.
Well, that announcement of the term paper brought them to life right quickly, right there at the tail end of the class. And that is the end of this tape, this, what is it, the third one that I say on Whitman, on Monday the 13th of May. And I lined it out, and as I look at it now, I really didn't take it out of Whitman's terminology quite enough. I made a statement about, you know, one statement after another. That may have helped him a little bit, but it, and I related it, but it's still in the metaphors, it's still in Whitman's language, right considerably. So that's the end of this tape on Monday the 13th of May, the 8th week, and 1968, and this is the third session on Whitman. This is the fourth session on Whitman. We go through right systematically, Song of Myself, first few of the sections, and then I pick up very hurriedly some of the latter ones. They start out with sort of an example of what a essay, the big essay of the term, is supposed to be like. And this is Wednesday, the 15th of May, 1968. Wednesday, the 15th of May, 1968. Fourth session on Whitman. And the only session on Song of Myself. On Song of Myself, the first few sections. And the proposition was that the members of the class would make the statements, and then we'd work them from there.
Now, the basic in this is it's a method of working that... I don't think you'd be used to. Yeah, you see, if you just listen to me now, I'll get out of your way, you see, and I'll also talk to you about what's on the board. I think what you want to do, you see, is to get into the writers more than you had an opportunity of doing. Now, the little paper, term paper, whatever you want to call it. Certainly not a term paper, not a library paper. Just a little paper, inquiry. See, this will take you into the material. I won't cover the material, but take you into it. You'll be working with material. You see, now that's the reason Stuffy, you see, is more verbal than the members of the class, because he talks more and he carries the ball more. Now this, you see, is your chance to carry the ball. And I think most of your rewards, the usefulness of the course, I think, comes from using material. Now, I've sketched this out for you, but see, it's only a sketch. There's more sketch in your mind than it is in mine. But see, you can work on this, and it'll take shape to where you'll see it more clearly than I do, without putting too much effort on it. Now I'm thinking, you see, I'm starting with Whitman's passage in the preface of 1855 on prudence, the sort of prudence he's interested in. That should be your springboard. You don't have to work chronologically. That's a kind of an elementary attitude towards the subject, to work chronologically or logically. Chronologically or logically, you see, abuse is abuse. Now, you see, if you listen to me and not, you see, you don't pay a bit of attention to what your instructor says. You've got your mind set on copying this. You're still copying this, and you don't know what you're copying. You're going to write me a paper like you wrote in eighth grade. I think this would be as good a springboard as any, because it's fresh in your mind. It's not complete, but it underlies Whitman. Now, he doesn't write a whole section on it like Thoreau does. But it's basic, you see. Now the idea, now he uses just the idea, he uses the word prudence. I don't know whether you see prudence as Poor Richard uses it and economists Rowe uses it are the same. That is broad terms. As he uses economy, is that broad as Poor Richard uses prudence? Now you see, Thoreau says, now I think of this strictly as economy. I'll open this door in just a second. Thoreau said that he could live well enough, you see, by working 6 weeks in a year, preferably at manual labor. And see, I would go along with Thoreau that the economy is the basis of one's whole outlook. Because if you're going to, invest in all the good things of this world and make all those payments on the first of the month, your life is going to be considerably different. And that's what they have in mind, you see, when they talk about this. Then you live and wait for the paycheck, and then pretty soon, you see, you've got to get a promotion. Or else your whole family is upset. I never saw young people as upset as they were when they would promotions didn't come through. And it doesn't matter what it is, it's just an excuse for promotion. Part of it is face and part of it is the money. That's what they're talking about, and I think that's what we all face. You don't equate me with them, you see. But now, I think first and last, Poor Richard is one who opens the subject. And I would try, if I use this subject, and I'm not recommending this at all, I'm putting this up as a sort of example, sort of model to go by. I would try to open up his whole subject as he did. Not in as much detail, naturally, but I'd try to look at it as broadly as he does. Now look at this. Thoreau uses this as a springboard for Walden. And Emerson uses it, you see, as his key idea in self-reliance. And he transforms the whole idea. What goes to self-reliance, you see, for Poor Richard, has no place. There's no persistence, you see, in dogged persistence in Emerson. He's not talking about that at all. So you see kind of how the thing works out. Now, I don't know how much of it is in Hawthorne. Hawthorne, you know, was poor and couldn't pay his bills. That's the reason he was in the position at the custom house. And later, that's the reason he took the position as the consul to Liverpool. It paid well, and he'd have a chance to pay his debts. Now, that's a biography. That's a biography. Now, I don't ask you to go into the biography. I can't do that either. But you can look right closely at this. Now, Hester seems to me, is basically Emersonian. Or based on that, you see that balance now in her. In Melville, Ishmael, I don't know, you see, the very first thing you hear from him when he says, call me Ishmael, I go to sea. But I go as a sailor because I've got no money. Except that's just part of the reason. So you see, it's basic in all of them. Now you see, what's in my mind is that if you look more closely, you see, in Hawthorne, it has to say, for this, looking for this, it'll kind of open up the book for you, if you don't have to do it just the night before you turn in your paper. I go ahead and copy it down, make any sort of notes that you can go by. Now, I hope you don't write on this, but I think this is the clearest type of subject that I could write on the board. Now, before we leave, I'll send out another one or two. Can you see? I can answer your question in just That's the best superficial logical way. You see, you don't have time to emphasize everybody. And what I try to do is to focus on something and then hit the others lightly. The ones that interest you, or the ones you know more about, whatever the way it works out. See how difficult that would be if you didn't have a running start. Oh, that would throw you. I don't believe anyone hardly would get through the first part of it. Do you think you wouldn't? The last thing I'd want to do is to make Whitman academic. To talk about him in class, though, we've got hardly any choice except to go about it in the academic manner. And I think the basis of that is just to make a statement that would apply to the poem or parts of the poem. Now, in the first stanza, what do you think he's doing? What is he supposed to do? Now, look at your papers and make a statement on it. All right, make a statement. That's all mechanical. Yes, sir. Oh, remember what I told you yesterday? See if you can do that. I said to you, he talked about the poet in the preface, 1855. But who is the poet? That's a genius, the scholar, the Emersonian individual, person like Ishmael, person like Thoreau, person like Hester. From my point of view, you see, we can equate those. Or if you want to say Whitman, you can, except, you know, it's not personal, actually. The I here is not Whitman. It's the Emersonian side. Now, let me see. Let's make it, find a handle for that. How would you say that? How would you put it down? How would you say it? First section, what he does is say he's going to delineate the Whitman point of view, Emersonian point of view. Could you now say a little better than that? Yeah, he celebrates, that's the word for it in poetry, the Emersonian personality. Emerson says, if I speak for myself, I will speak for others, like you said. Whitman makes that the basis of his poem, the opening statement. In the place of Virgil, you know Virgil's famous line, of arms and the man, I sing. Go ahead. But now what he does there is modifying Emerson. In what direction? Harbor for good or bad, I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check. Without check, you see. Now, in art, his theory of art is that he doesn't want to be checked by meter and stanzaic forms. Now, what does he mean here when he says nature without check? Well, he doesn't want too many hindrances. You think he's talking there about the art of it? I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check? That means he's not going to finish all of his sentences unless he wants to. I don't think it means that. I think I was just reading that into it. Let's go back to you made your statement, and I said that would be the same thing we've already said, but what he's doing there is modifying Emerson. In what direction? Yes. Now, give us an adjective for that. That's a good point, you see. We're working on it now. What? He's adapting it in what direction? His own direction, yes. But what does that mean? Huh? Well, I'll say it for you. He's more extreme than Emerson. He takes Emerson much farther than Emerson would go. But now, you see, that doesn't mean much. Let's come back and see if it'll work out. Now, look in two.
that's a good one. Start from the poem, from the stanza. Yes. Houses and rooms. What's this contrast here? Houses and rooms are full of perfumes, and he likes those, but he won't be tempted by houses and perfumes. What is it he is looking for in the second part? What's that? The open air, yes, atmosphere. He wants a clear air. Now, he said that before? Huh? Has he said that before? Where? Well, we're getting a little out of chronology. This is the first time he'd said it, see? First poem he wrote. But he said it again in the later one. I mean, we trip up on those things all the time. Now, what did he say about the air, you see? I'm mad for it, to be in contact with it. See, Emerson wouldn't say anything like that. I don't believe he would now. Yes. Private life. Well, we brought that same up. We brought up that same thing. Question with Thoreau. We say he went out there to live a private life. We talked about Thoreau a little bit. You see that he was withdrawing and looking out in solitude. We still got in position. You remember that? Yeah. Also say that this is the Emersonian song. Here's the song of my Emersonian self. Because what he's doing is pursuing the same inquiry that the others have pursued. And you find a similar positions in the others. So it's something that they have in common. Hey, he was involved in. Well, now, you know, I told you I'd read his editorials in the newspaper for 2 years, and he's a good party man. He's a Whig. And he doesn't bear, he knows all the party politicians, and he supports some, opposes others. So he's straightforward as far as politics goes. Now, in the poetry, it's a little bit different. Yeah, that sounds a little more like the open road. Well, it develops too, and this is his first, you see. Now look at that next. Now, and the atmosphere is not a perfume. Now, what is he doing there? In a way, following his theory of art, that the concrete alone is strong, and the organization also hides the subject, he shows what it is to be in the air. He just doesn't make a statement, let it go at that. You see, the atmosphere is not a perfume. It has no taste or distillation. It's odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I'm in love with it. I'll go to the bank, and I'm mad for it. And the smoke of my own breath, that's the best place. My respiration and inspiration, the sniff of green leaves, you see that? And the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag. Now, I think unless you read that as he's made a statement and now he works it out, I don't think you're making contact with Whitman. Otherwise, you see all this stuff in here, it looks just cluttered, like it clutters it. And I think you'd find it cluttered if you're just reading this by yourself, yeah. There was never any more inception than there is now. Great is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. In other words, what he says here, the learned and the unlearned see equally well. Now, in this case, you're the unlearned and I'm the learned. Let me read it for you in my reading. And you take it as you can. I've heard what the talkers were talking. Now he's sarcastic here. That's that polemic manner of his. The talk of the beginning and the end. Now who is it that talks about the beginning and the end? You don't know that. But in the old days they used to argue a lot. They'd argue about they'd have the evidences of the existence of the deity. And one of the proofs of the deity was that the world was created. And logically, anything created will end. And if it's created, it has a creator. And he
says that's all foolishness. That people are just talking and they're not getting anywhere. Now, I've never read a book on this, so I don't know. Now, he says, that's not right. He says, these times are just like all other times. And he gets it from creative evolution, the Darwinian approach. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age. There'll never be any more perfection. And the same saying, urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge. That's that evolutionary urge. Biological urge of the world. And then he says things I don't follow. And then he says, to elaborate is no avail, that everybody realizes this. You don't have to be a learned man to see this, but I think you have to be sort of halfway learned in order to follow him. Now, there you are. Yes, there's a good bit of this in Whitman. Now, you see, you may not care for it. I think if you don't care for it, you can just eliminate it. I don't think it's basic, you know, in Whitman. But at one time, I remember I used to be interested in this, and I used to read book after book about this. And I used to go to the American Museum of Natural History and see the exhibits that showed this. What are you going to say, Mom? All right. In this case, you're more learned than I am. I'll have to make a note of that. Now, he's saying the same thing in the next one. Trippers and askers surround me. Trippers, people who want to trip, you see, and talk about little logical things, almost like poor Richard, yes. I don't think he goes that far into it, but you see, you're going farther than I know about it. Now, look at number five. That's on sex, the physical side of life. Now, there's a great deal of that in Whitman. The children of Adam and Calamus, all sort of taken from that point of view. And that's one of the things that went hard on Whitman in his time. He's treating sex, you see, so that people would, I don't know, sort of like the Kinsey Report. He's treating it in a...
like it's something natural.
Yes. 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 Oh, well, he also has the poetic touch of it, you see. Now, I won't read those sections with you, and I don't care about you reading them for me. I'd rather take some of the other sections. And now in six, for instance, I think we can do that more justice. A child said, what is the grass? Fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. Now, this is the first one that sounds like poetry. The rest of it sounds, I don't know what it sounds like. It sounds like the early Whitman. Now, look here. The first poetic part, I would say, what is the grass? Now, back of this, look here. Back of this is Ishmael's inquiry into the world outside. Back of this. This has that long foreground that leads him to observe whales climb the crow's nest. Now, the same thing is in Hawthorne, you see, this wilderness, forest, where Dimmesdale and Hester have their interview. And it's constantly in Hawthorne's mind, that appeal of the two, of civilization, the society, and the forest. The promontory where Hester's cottage is. But now here's one thing. Whitman will not be abstract. And he won't toy with some indigestible notion about nature. Or the transcendental. He sees it in something concrete. And you say right off, it's symbolic. But he's not writing it as symbolic. So Whitman is trying to escape the abstract and symbolic. It's the grass, as Emily says, that wall of green. Oh, she does it so much better than Whitman does. Now look, the child brings it to him and wants to know what it is. And he doesn't know, he says, any more than the child. And what he means is that he means too that the philosophers and the theologians don't know any more than he does. So he presents this set of possibilities, all of them which sound like Ishmael and Thoreau of Walden and Hester. All of them could have said this, maybe. Now look. The first thing he says, it is the flag of my disposition. Out of hopeful green stuff woven. That's all he says. I think that's marvelous. That's what Whitman is, you see. That is the flag of his disposition. Out of hopeful green stuff woven. Now, do you think that could be said of the others? Ishmael? You see that hopeful green stuff in Ishmael? What?
It seems like this whole
thing. It is the handkerchief of the Lord. Now, look at that. What do you think he's talking about there? I guess it is a handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some ways in the corner, that we may see and remark whose. Now, what's he talking about there? Huh? Now, look. In those days, He has in mind this fine old romantic custom. In those days when young men and women did not meet so easily and looked at each other from a distance, and the girl designedly drops her handkerchief so the young man can pick it up and they can speak. Then, a little later, she can leave a little note for him and the Bible, and leave the Bible in the pew, and he can come after church and read it. Now, that's what Whitman, that's the old thing, that's that old story that Whitman, I think, has in mind. Yes, that's what you'd do for most of this. You'd miss the whole point of most of it. You've read Huckleberry Finn, you know, you could define. It's in that. The Shepherdson's on the Grangerford, it is on the river. Now look at here, you see? What is the grass? It is a handkerchief designedly dropped so that we'll pick it up and say who. In other words, the grass is an argument in favor of the divinity, or there is some purpose in the world. Or it bears a message. A message is written on those to those who can read the hieroglyphic that it is common, the commonplace. Grows everywhere, and look at there, you see. He won't leave the statement there, but he puts it in. And he makes it comical, ludicrous. And it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white folks, Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff. I give them the same, I receive them the same. It's almost nonsense. But it's so commonplace. It is this hieroglyphic, you see. That's what it means. Now look. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. And he pursues that thought there. And you say, what does Whitman know about it? He knows as much about it as St. Paul. What he's saying is, you know, that this is one of his signs and evidences, and it's comforting, this wall of green that he talks about. Let me see. That's one of the beautiful ones. But see, his sense of beauty is not, he doesn't care for it. Now look at 8. In 8, the cases come first and the statement at the end, the same as sections 3 and 4, where he says, the shows are not myself. See, I mind not the show or the resonance of them, the blab of the pave, tires of carts, slough of boot soles. All these things might be thought as noise and interference. But he says, something in me rises above those things. Now, look here. Here's this one. This is very hard to read. Now, look at 9, 10, 12, 13. They have no idea. He starts out in 9. The big doors of the country barn stand open and ready. The dried grass of the harvest time loads a slow-drawn wagon. The clear light plays on the brown, gray, and green and intertins. The eyes are packed to the sagging mole. I am there. I help. I came stretched atop the load. See, this is a haymaking seed. Now, why does he bring that up? There's no idea in it. Now, where is the idea? Well, what? Well, you have to keep going until you find where he states it. Now, let me see. He states it in the middle of number 13. On me, the caresser of life, wherever moving, backward as well as forward, absorbing all to myself and for this song. Now, isn't that something? Just one little scene after another he puts in to show that he is what he calls the caresser of life. Absorb all these things for myself and for this song. Take overdone, exaggerated manner of his, and he's talking here about the commonplace. And what he does is give a series of extreme cases. I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars, and a pismire is something, and I don't know what that is. What's pismire? A tree toad. Who cares?
This is the end of Song of Myself, 15th of May. I'll just cut it off. There's not much more. The 15th of May, 1948, the fourth session on Whitman. The 15th of May, and this is the end of Channel 2 over. The 15th of May, 1968. I'll just cut off our first and only discussion of Song of Myself. The first and only discussion of Song of Myself. That's 33, and then I go to the very last one and come back to one of them. I'll mention those at the beginning of next time.
This hinge in my hand is above all machinery. A cow chewing is...